list. But, credit where credit is due, she greeted me with a fair imitation of warmth and kissed me on the cheek. She was wearing a knitted ski cap that made her look like an elderly child and offered me a tight smile of thanks when I whisked it off her head. "I didn't get the memo either," I said. Deke pumped my hand. "Merry Christmas, George. Glad to see you. Gosh, something smells good." He wandered off to the kitchen. A few moments later, I heard Sadie laugh and say, "Get your fingers out of that, Deke. Didn't your mama raise you right?" Ellie was slowly undoing the keg buttons of her coat, never taking her eyes from my face. "Is it wise, George?" she asked, "what you and Sadie are doing? Is it wise?" Before I could answer, Sadie swept in with the turkey she'd been fussing over ever since we'd gotten back from the Candlewood bungalows. We sat down and linked hands. "Dear Lord, please bless this food to our bodies," Sadie said, "and please bless our fellowship, one with the other, to our minds and our spirits." I started to let go, but she was still gripping my hand with her left and Ellie's with her right. "And please bless George and Ellie with friendship. Help George remember her kindness. And help Ellie to remember that without George, there would be a girl from this town with a terribly scarred face. I love them both. And it's sad to see mistrust in their eyes. For Jesus' sake. Amen."
"Amen," Deke said heartily. "Good prayer." He winked at Ellie.
I think part of Ellie wanted to get up and leave. It might have been the reference to Bobby Jill that stopped her, or maybe it was how much she'd come to respect her new school librarian. Maybe it even had a little to do with me. I'd like to think so. Sadie was looking at Miss Ellie with her old anxiety. "That turkey looks absolutely wonderful," Ellie said, and handed me her plate. "Would you help me to a drumstick, George? And don't spare the stuffing." Sadie could be vulnerable, and Sadie could be clumsy. But Sadie could also be very, very brave. How I loved her. Lee, Marina, and June went to the Demorenschilds to see in the new year. I was left to my own lonely devices, but when Sadie called and asked if I'd take her to the New Year's Eve dance at Jody's Bountiful Grange, I hesitated. "I know what you're thinking," she said, "but this'll be better than last year. We'll make it better, George." So there we were at 8 o'clock, once more dancing beneath sagging nets of balloons. This year's band was called the Dominoes. They featured a four-man horn section instead of the Dick Dale-style surf guitars that had dominated the previous year's dance, but they also knew how to lay it down. There were the same two bowls of pink lemonade and ginger ale, one soft and one spiked. There were the same smokers clustered beneath the fire escape in the chill air. But it was better than last year. There was a great sense of relief and happiness. The world had passed under a nuclear shadow in October. But then it had passed back out again. I heard several approving comments about how Kennedy had made the bad old Russian bear back down. Around 9 o'clock, during a slow dance, Sadie suddenly screamed and broke away from me. I was sure she'd spotted John Clayton, and my heart jumped into my throat. But that had been a scream of pure happiness, because the two newcomers she'd spotted were Mike Coslaw, looking absurdly handsome in a tweed topcoat, and Bobby Jill Allnett. Sadie ran to them and tripped over someone's foot. Mike caught her and swung her around. Bobby Jill waved to me, a little shyly. I shook Mike's hand and kissed Bobby Jill on the cheek. The disfiguring scar was now a faint pink line. "Doctor says it'll be all gone by next summer," she said. "He called me his fastest healing patient, thanks to you."
"I got a part in Death of a Salesman, Mr. A," Mike said. "I'm playing Biff."
"Typecasting," I said. Just watch out for flying pies. I saw him talking to the band's lead singer during one of the breaks and knew perfectly well what was coming. When they got back on the stand, the singer said, "I've got a special request. Did we have a George Amberson and Sadie Dunhill in the house? George and Sadie? Come on up here, George and Sadie. Out of your seats and onto your feet." We walked toward the bandstand through a storm of applause. Sadie was laughing and blushing. She shook her fist at Mike. He grinned. The boy was leaving his face. The man was coming in. A little shyly, but coming. The singer counted off and the brass section swung into that downbeat I still hear in my dreams. Ba-da-da-ba-da-dee-da-dum. I held my hands out to her. She shook her head, but began to swing her hips a little just the same. "Go get him, Miss Sadie," Bobby Jill shouted. "Do the thing." The crowd joined in. "Go, go, go." She gave in and took my hands. We danced. At midnight, the band played Auld Lang Syne, different arrangement from last year, same sweet song, and the balloons came drifting down. All around us, couples were kissing and embracing. We did the same. "Happy New Year, Joe." She pulled back from me, frowning. "What's wrong?" I'd had a sudden image of the Texas School Book Depository, an ugly brick square with windows like eyes. This was the year it would become an American icon. "It won't. I'll never let you get that far, Lee. You'll never be in that sixth-floor window. That's my promise." "George?" "Goose walked over my grave, I guess," I said. "Happy New Year." I went to kiss her, but she held me back for a moment. "It's almost here, isn't it, what you came to do?"
"Yes," I said.
"But it's not tonight. For tonight, it's just us. So kiss me, honey, and dance with me." I had two lives in late 1962 and early 1963. The good one was in Jody and at the Candlewood in Killeen. The other was in Dallas. Lee and Marina got back together. Their first stop in Dallas was a dump just around the corner from West Neely. De Morenschild helped them move in. George Boo wasn't in evidence. Neither were any of the other Russian emigres. Lee had driven them away. "They hated him," Al had written in his notes, and below that, "he wanted them to." The crumbling red brick at 604 Elsbeth Street had been divided into four or five apartments bursting with poor folks who worked hard, drank hard, and produced hordes of snot-nosed yelling kids. The place actually made the Oswald's Fort Worth domicile look good. I didn't need electronic assistance to monitor the deteriorating condition of their marriage. Marina continued to wear shorts even after the weather turned cool, as if to taunt him with her bruises and her sex appeal, of course. June usually sat between them in her stroller. She no longer cried much during their shouting matches, only watched, sucking her thumb or her pacifier. One day in November of 1962, I came back from the library and observed Lee and Marina on the corner of West Neely and Elsbeth shouting at each other. Several people, mostly women at that hour of the day, had come out on their porches to watch. June sat in the stroller wrapped in a fuzzy pink blanket, silent and forgotten. They were arguing in Russian, but the latest bone of contention was clear enough from Lee's jabbing finger. She was wearing a straight black skirt, I don't know if they were called pencil skirts back then or not, and the zipper on her left hip was halfway down. Probably it just snagged in the cloth, but listening to him rave, you would have thought she was trolling for men. She brushed back her hair, pointed at June, then waved a hand at the house they were now inhabiting, the broken gutters dripping black water, the trash and beer cans on the bald front lawn, and screamed at him in English, You seek happy lives, then bring wife and baby to this pigsty.
He flushed all the way to his hairline and clutched his arms across his thin chest as if to anchor his hands and keep them from doing damage. He might have succeeded, that time at least, if she hadn't laughed, then twirled one finger around her ear in a gesture that must be common to all cultures. She started to turn away. He hauled her back, bumping the stroller and almost overturning it. Then he slugged her. She fell down on the cracked sidewalk and covered her face when he bent over her.
Noch, nie, noch, no more hit me.
He didn't hit her. He yanked her to her feet and shook her instead. Her head snapped and rolled.
You,
a rusty voice said from my left. It made me jump.
You, boy.
It was an elderly woman on a walker. She was standing on her porch in a pink flannel nightgown with a quilted jacket over it. Her graying hair stood straight up, making me think of Elsa Lanchester's 20,000-volt home permanent in The Bride of Frankenstein.
That man is beating on that woman. Go down there and put a stop to it.
No, ma'am, I said. My voice was unsteady. I thought of adding, I won't come between a man and his wife, but that would have been a lie. The truth was that I wouldn't do anything that might disturb the future.
You coward, she said.
Call the cops, I almost said, but bit it back just in time. If it wasn't in the old lady's head and I put it there, that could also change the course of the future. Did the cops come, ever? Al's notebook didn't say. All I knew was that Oswald would never be jugged for spousal abuse. I suppose in that time and that place few men were. He was dragging her up the front walk with one hand and yanking the stroller with the other. The old woman gave me a final withering glance, then clumped back into her house. The other spectators were doing the same. Show over. From my living room, I trained my binoculars on the red brick monstrosity catacorner from me. 2 hours later, just as I was about to give up the surveillance, Marina emerged with a small pink suitcase in one hand and the blanket-wrapped baby in the other. She had changed the offending skirt for slacks and what appeared to be two sweaters. The day had turned cold. She hurried down the street, several times looking back over her shoulder for Lee. When I was sure he wasn't going to follow her, I did. She went as far as Mr. Car Wash, 4 blocks down West Davis, and used the pay telephone there. I sat across the street at the bus stop with a newspaper spread out in front of me. 20 minutes later, trusty old George Boo showed up. She spoke to him earnestly. He led her around to the passenger side of the car and opened the door for her. She smiled and pecked him on the corner of the mouth. I'm sure he treasured both. Then he got in behind the wheel, and they drove away. That night there was another argument in front of the Elsbeth Street house, and once again most of the immediate neighborhood turned out to watch. Feeling there was safety in numbers, I joined them. Someone, almost certainly Boo, had sent George and Jean de Morinchil to get the rest of Marina's things. Boo probably figured they were the only ones who'd be able to get in without physical restraints being imposed on Lee.
"Be damned if I'll hand anything over,"
Lee shouted, oblivious of the rapt neighbors taking in every word. Cords stood out on his neck. His face was once more a bright, steaming red. How he must have hated that tendency to blush like a little girl who's been caught passing love notes. De Morinchil took the reasonable approach.
Think, mein Freund, this way, there's still a chance. If she sends the police...
He gave a shrug and lifted his hands to the sky.
Give me an hour, then,
Lee said. He was showing teeth, but that expression was the farthest thing in the world from a smile. It'll give me a chance to put a knife through every one of her dresses and break every one of the toys those fat cats sent to buy my daughter. What's going on? A young man asked me. He was about 20 and had pulled up on a Schwinn.
Domestic argument, I guess. Osmond, and whatever his name, right? Russian lady left him? About time, I'd say. And that guy there's crazy. He's a commie, you know it? I think I heard something about that. Lee was marching up the porch steps with his head back and his spine straight, Napoleon, retreating from Moscow, when Jean de Morenschild called to him sharply. "Stop it, you stupid Nick!" Lee turned to her, his eyes wide, unbelieving and hurt. He looked at de Morenschild, his expression saying, "Can't you control your wife?" But de Morenschild said nothing. He looked amused, like a jaded theater goer watching a play that's actually not too bad. Not great, not Shakespeare, but a perfectly acceptable time passer. "Jean, if you love your wife, Lee, for God's sake, stop acting like a spoiled brat. Behave." "You can't talk to me like that." Under stress, his southern accent grew stronger. "I can. I will. I do," she said. "Let us get her things, or I'll call the police myself." Lee said, "Tell her to shut up and mind her business, George." De Morenschild laughed cheerily. "Today you are our business, Lee." Then he grew serious. "I'm losing respect for you, comrade. Let us in now. If you value my friendship as I value yours, let us in now." Lee's shoulders slumped, and he stood aside. Jean marched up the steps, not even sparing him a glance. But de Morenschild stopped and enveloped Lee, who was now painfully thin, in a powerful embrace. After a moment or two, Oswald hugged him back. I realized with a mixture of pity and revulsion that the boy, that was all he was really, had begun weeping. "What are they?" the young man with the bike asked. "Couple of queers?" "They're queer, all right," I said. "Just not the way you mean." Later that month, I returned from one of my weekends with Sadie to discover Marina and June back in residence at the shithole on Elsbeth Street. For a little while, the family seemed at peace. Lee went to work, now creating photographic enlargements instead of aluminum screen doors, and came home, sometimes with flowers. Marina greeted him with kisses. Once, she showed him the front lawn where she had picked up all the garbage, and he applauded her. That made her laugh, and when she did, I saw that her teeth had been fixed. I don't know how much George Boo had to do with that, but my guess is plenty. I watched this scene from the corner and was, once more, startled by the rusty voice of the old lady with the walker. "It won't last, you know." "Could be right," I said. "He's probably gonna kill her. I've seen it before." Below her electric hair, her eyes surveyed me with cold contempt. "And you won't step in to do nothing, will you, Sonny Biscuit?" "I will," I told her. "If things get bad enough, I will step in." That was a promise I meant to keep, although not on Marina's behalf. The day after Sadie's Boxing Day dinner, there was a note from Oswald in my mailbox, although it was signed A. Hiddell. This alias was in Al's notes. The A stood for Alec, Marina's pet name for him during their Minsk days. The communication didn't disturb me since everyone on the street seemed to have gotten one just like it. The flyers had been printed on hot pink paper, probably filched from Oswald's current place of employment, and I saw a dozen or more flapping up the gutters. The residents of Dallas's Oak Cliff neighborhood were not known for putting litter in its place. "Protest Channel 9 fascism. Home of segregationist Billy James Hargis. Protest fascist ex-general Edwin Walker." During the Thursday night telecast of the Billy James Hargis so-called Christian Crusade, Channel 9 will give airtime to General Edwin Walker, a right-wing fascist who has encouraged JFK to invade the peaceful peoples of Cuba and who has fomented anti-black, anti-integration hate speak all over the South. If you have doubts about the accuracy of this information, check the TV guide. These two men stand for everything we fought against in World War II, and their fascist ravings have no place on the airwaves. Edwin Walker was one of the white supremacists who tried to bar James Meredith from attending Ole Miss. If you love America, protest the free airtime given to men who preach hate and violence. Write a letter. Better still, come to Channel 9 on December 27 and sit in. A. Hidell, President of Hands Off Cuba, Dallas-Fort Worth Branch. I briefly pondered the misspellings, then folded the flyer and put it in the box where I kept my manuscripts. If there was a protest at the station, it wasn't reported in the Slimes Herald the day after the Hargis Walker telecast. I doubt that anyone turned up, including Lee himself. I certainly didn't. But I tuned into Channel 9 on Thursday night, anxious to see the man Lee, probably Lee, was soon going to try to kill. At first it was just Hargis, sitting behind an office-set desk and pretending to scribble important notes while a canned choir sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic. He was a fattish fellow with a lot of plastered-back black hair. As the choir faded out, he put down his pen, looked into the camera, and said, "Welcome to the Christian Crusade, neighbors. I come with good news. Jesus loves you. Yes, he does, every last one of you. Won't you join me in prayer?" Hargis bent the Almighty's ear for at least 10 minutes. He covered the usual stuff, thanking God for the chance to spread the gospel and instructing him to bless those who'd sent in love offerings. Then he got down to business, asking God to arm his chosen people with the sword and buckler of righteousness so we could defeat communism, which had reared its ugly head just 90 miles off the shores of Florida. He asked God to grant President Kennedy the wisdom, which Hargis, being closer to the big guy, already possessed, to go in there and root out the tares of godlessness. He also demanded that God put an end to the growing communist threat on American college campuses. Folk music seemed to have something to do with it, but Hargis kind of lost the thread on that part. He finished by thanking God for his guest tonight, the hero of Anzio and the Chosin Reservoir, General Edwin A. Walker. Walker appeared not in uniform, but in a khaki suit that closely resembled one. The creases in his pants looked sharp enough to shave with. His stony face reminded me of the cowboy actor Randolph Scott. He shook Hargis's hand, and they talked about communism, which was rife not just on the college campuses, but in the halls of Congress, and the scientific community as well. They touched on fluoridation. Then they schmoozed about Cuba, which Walker called the cancer of the Caribbean. I could see why Walker had failed so badly in his run for the Texas governorship the year before. At the front of a high school class, he would have put the kids to sleep even in period one when they were freshest. But Hargis moved him along, smoothly, interjecting, "Praise Jesus," and "God's witness, brother," whenever things got a little sticky. They discussed an upcoming barnstorm crusade through the South called Operation Midnight Ride, and then Hargis invited Walker to clear the air concerning certain scurrilous charges of segregationism that have surfaced in the New York press and elsewhere. Walker finally forgot he was on television and came to life. "You know, that's nothing but a truckload of commie propaganda."
"I know it," Hargis exclaimed, "and God wants you to tell it, brother.
I spent my life in the U.S. Army, and I'll be a soldier in my heart until the day I die." If Lee had his way, that would be in roughly 3 months. As a soldier, I always did my duty. When President Eisenhower ordered me to Little Rock during the civil disturbances of 1957, this had to do with the forced integration of Central High School, as you know, I did my duty. But, Billy, I'm also a soldier of God, a Christian soldier. Praise Jesus. And as a Christian, I know that forced integration is just flat out wrong. It's Constitution wrong, states' rights wrong, and Bible wrong.
Tell it, Hargis said, and wiped a tear from his cheek, or maybe it was sweat that had oozed through his makeup.
Do I hate the Negro race? Those who say that, and those who worked to drive me from the military service I loved, are liars and communists. You know better. The men I served with know better, and God knows better. He leaned forward in the guest's chair. Do you think the Negro teachers in Alabama and Arkansas and Louisiana and the great state of Texas want integration? They do not. They see it as a slap in the face to their own skills and hard work. Do you think that Negro students want to go to school with whites naturally better equipped for reading, writing, and arithmetic? Do you think real Americans want the sort of race mongrelization that will result from this sort of mingling? Of course they don't. Praise Jesus. I thought about the sign I'd seen in North Carolina, the one pointing to a path bordered with poison ivy. Colored, it had said. Walker didn't deserve killing, but he could certainly do with a brisk shaking. I'd give anyone a big old praise Jesus on that one. My attention had wandered, but something Walker was now saying brought it back in a hurry. It was God, not General Edwin Walker, who ordained the Negro position in his world when he gave them a different skin color and a different set of talents, more athletic talents. What does the Bible tell us about this difference and why the Negro race has been cursed to so much pain and travail? We only have to look at the 9th chapter of Genesis, Billy. Praise God for His holy word. Walker closed his eyes and raised his right hand, as if testifying in court. And Noah drank of the wine, and was drunken, and lay uncovered. Ham saw the nakedness of his father, and told them who stood without. But Shem and Japheth, one father of the Arab race, one father of the white race, I know you know this, Billy, but not everybody does. Not everybody has the good old Bible learning we got at our mother's knees. Praise God for Christian mothers. You tell it. Shem and Japheth didn't look. And when Noah awoke and found out what had been going on, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. He shall be a servant even unto servants, a hewer of wood and a drawer of water." I snapped the TV off. What I saw of Lee and Marina during January and February of 1963 made me think of a T-shirt Christy sometimes used to wear during the last year of our marriage. There was a fiercely grinning pirate on the front with this message below him: "The beatings will continue until morale improves." Plenty of beatings took place at 604 Elsbeth Street that winter. We in the neighborhood heard Lee's shouting and Marina's cries, sometimes of anger, sometimes of pain. Nobody did anything, and that included me. Not that she was the only wife to take regular beatings in Oak Cliff. The Friday and Saturday night fights seemed to be a local tradition. All I remember wanting during those dismal gray months was for the squalid, endless soap opera to be over so I could be with Sadie full-time. I would verify that Lee was solo when he attempted to kill General Walker, then conclude my business. Oswald acting alone once didn't necessarily mean he'd been acting alone both times, but it was the best I could do. With the I's dotted and the T's crossed, most of them anyway, I would pick my time and place and shoot Lee Oswald as coldly as I had shot Frank Dunning. Time passed, slowly, but it passed. And then one day, not long before the Oswalds moved into the apartment on Neely Street above my own, I saw Marina talking to the old lady with the walker and the Elsa Lanchester hair. They were both smiling. The old lady asked her something. Marina laughed, nodded, and held her hands out in front of her stomach. I stood at my window with the curtain drawn back, my binoculars in one hand and my mouth hanging open. Al's notes had said nothing about this development, either because he didn't know or didn't care. But I cared. The wife of the man I'd waited for 4 years to kill was once again pregnant. Chapter 21. The Oswalds became my upstairs neighbors on March 2, 1963. They hand-carried their possessions, mostly in liquor store cartons, from the crumbling brick box on Elsbeth Street. Soon the wheels of the little Japanese tape recorder were turning on a regular basis, but mostly I listened in with the earphones. That way the conversations upstairs were normal, instead of slowed down, but of course I couldn't understand much of it anyway. The week after the Oswalds moved into their new digs, I visited one of the pawn shops on Greenville Avenue to buy a gun. The first revolver the pawnbroker showed me was the same Colt 38 model I'd bought in Derry. "This is excellent protection against muggers and homebreakers," the pawnbroker said. "Dead accurate up to 20 yards." 15, I said. "I heard 15. The pawnee raised his eyebrows. "Okay, say 15. Anyone stupid enough to try mugging me out of my cash is going to be a lot closer than that. That's how the pitch goes. To brace you is going to be in at close quarters, so what do you say?" My first impulse, just to break that sense of chiming but slightly discordant harmony, was to tell him I wanted something else, maybe a 45. But breaking the harmony might be a bad idea, who knew? What I did know was that the 38 I'd bought in Derry had done the job. "How much?" "I'll let you have it for 12. That was $2 more than I'd paid in Derry, but of course that had been 4.5 years ago. Adjusting for inflation, 12 seemed about right. I told him to add a box of bullets, and he had a deal. When the broker saw me putting the gun and the ammo in the briefcase I'd brought along for that purpose, he said, "Why don't you let me sell you a holster, son? You don't sound like you're from around here, and you probably don't know, but you can carry legal in Texas. No permit needed if you don't have a felony record. You got a felony record?" "No, but I don't expect to be mugged in broad daylight." The broker offered a dark smile. "On Greenville Avenue, you can never tell what's going to happen. Man blew his own head off just a block and a half from here a few years ago." "Really?" "Yes, sir. Outside a bar called the Desert Rose. Over a woman, of course. Don't that figure?" "I guess," I said, "although sometimes it's politics." "No, no. At the bottom, it's always a woman, son." I'd found a parking space 4 blocks west of the pawn shop, and in order to get back to my new to me anyway, car, I had to pass Faith Financial, where I'd laid my bet on the Miracle Pirates in the fall of 1960. The Sharpie who'd paid off my $1,200 was standing out front having a smoke. He was wearing his green eye shade. His eyes passed over me, but seemingly without interest or recognition. That was on a Friday afternoon, and I drove straight from Greenville Avenue to Killeen, where Sadie met me at the Candlewood Bungalows. We spent the night, as was our habit that winter. The next day, she drove back to Jody, where I joined her on Sunday for church. After the benediction, during the part where we shook hands with the people all around us, saying, "Peace be with you," my thoughts turned not comfortably to the gun, now stowed in the trunk of my car. Over the Sunday noon meal, Sadie asked, "How much longer until you do what you have to do?" If everything goes the way I hope, not much more than a month. And if it doesn't? I scrubbed my hands through my hair and went to the window. Then I don't know. Anything else on your mind? Yes, she said calmly. There's cherry cobbler for afters. Would you like whipped cream on yours? Very much, I said. I love you, honey. You better, she said, getting up to fetch dessert, because I'm kind of out on a limb here. I stayed at the window. A car came rolling slowly down the street, an oldie but a goodie, as the jocks on K-Life said, and I felt that harmonic chime again. But I was always feeling it now, and sometimes it meant nothing. One of Christie's AA slogans came to my mind, F-E-A-R, fear, standing for false evidence appearing real. This time a click of association came, though. The car was a white over red Plymouth Fury, like the one I'd seen in the parking lot of the Warrumbo Mill, not far from the drying shed where the rabbit hole into 1958 came out. I remembered touching the trunk to make sure it was real. This one had an Arkansas plate instead of a Maine one, but still, that chime, that harmonic chime. Sometimes I felt that if I knew what that chime meant, I'd know everything. Probably stupid, but true. The yellow card man knew, I thought. He knew, and it killed him. My latest harmonic signaled left, turned at the stop sign, and disappeared toward Main Street. Come eat dessert, you, Sadie said from behind me, and I jumped. The AAs say F-E-A-R, fear, stands for something else as well. Fuck everything and run. When I got back to Neely Street that night, I put on the earphones and listened to the latest recording. I expected nothing but Russian, but this time I got English as well, and splashing sounds. Marina speaks Russian. Lee. I can't, Mama. I'm in the tub with Junie. More splashing and laughter. Lee's and the baby's high chortle. Lee. Mama, we got water on the floor. Junie splash. Bad girl. Marina. Mop it up. I busy. Busy. But she is also laughing. Lee. I can't. You want the baby to... Russian. Marina speaks Russian, scolding and laughing at the same time. More splashing. Marina is humming some pop song from K-Life. It sounds sweet. Lee. Mama, bring us our toys. Marina. Da, da, always you must have the toys. Splashing. Loud. The door to the bathroom must be all the way open now. Marina speaks Russian. Lee, pouty, little boy's voice. Mama, you forgot our rubber ball. Big splash. The baby screams with delight. Marina. There. All toys for prince and princessa. Laughter from all three. Their joy turns me cold. Lee. Mama, bring us a... Russian word. We have water on our ear. Marina, laughing. Oh, my God. What next? I lay awake a long time that night, thinking of the three of them. Happy, for once. And why not? 214 West Neely wasn't much, but it was still a step up. Maybe they were even sleeping in the same bed. June, for once, happy. Instead of scared to death. And now a fourth in the bed as well, the one growing in Marina's belly. Things began to move faster, as they had in Derry, only now Time's arrow was flying toward April 10th instead of Halloween. Al's notes, which I had depended on to get me this far, became less helpful. Leading up to the attempt on Walker's life, they concentrated almost solely on Lee's actions and movements. And that winter, there was a lot more to their lives, Marina's in particular. For one thing, she had finally made a friend. Not a sugar daddy wannabe like George Boo, but a woman friend. Her name was Ruth Payne, and she was a Quaker lady.
"Russian speaker,"
Al had noted in a laconic style not much like his earlier notes.
"Met at party 2-something-63. Marina separated from Lee and living with the Payne woman at the time of the Kennedy assassination."
And then, as if it were no more than an afterthought,
"Lee stored MC in Payne garage, wrapped in blanket."
By MC, he meant the mail-order Mannlicher Carcano rifle with which Lee planned to kill General Walker. I don't know who threw the party where Lee and Marina met the Paynes. I don't know who introduced them. De Mornschild? Boo? Probably one or the other, because by then the rest of the émigrés were giving the Oswalds a wide berth. Hubby was a sneering know-it-all. Wifey, a punching bag, who'd passed up God knew how many chances to leave him for good. What I do know is Marina Oswald's potential escape hatch arrived behind the wheel of a Chevrolet station wagon, white over red, on a rainy day in the middle of March. She parked at the curb and looked around dubiously, as if not sure she'd come to the right address. Ruth Payne was tall, although not as tall as Sadie, and painfully thin. Her brownish hair was banged over a huge expanse of forehead in front and flipped in back, a style that did not flatter her. She wore rimless glasses on a nose splashed with freckles. To me, peering through a crack in the curtains, she looked like the kind of woman who steered clear of meat and marched in Ban the Bomb demonstrations. And that was pretty much who Ruth Payne was, I think. A woman who was New Age before New Age was cool. Marina must have been watching for her because she came clattering down the outside stairs with the baby in her arms. A blanket flipped up over June's head to protect her from the drifting drizzle. Ruth Payne smiled tentatively and spoke carefully, putting a space between each word. "Hello, Mrs. Oswald. I'm Ruth Payne. Do you remember me?"
"Da," Marina said. "Yes."
Then she added something in Russian. Ruth replied in the same language, although haltingly. Marina invited her in. I waited until I heard the creak of their footsteps above me, then donned the earphones connected to the lamp bug. What I heard was a conversation in mixed English and Russian. Marina corrected Ruth several times, sometimes with laughter. I understood enough to figure out why Ruth Payne had come. Like Paul Gregory, she wanted Russian lessons. I understood something else from her frequent laughter and increasingly easy conversation. They liked each other. I was glad for Marina. If I killed Oswald after his attempt on General Walker, the New Agey Ruth Payne might take her in. I could hope. Ruth only came twice to Neely Street for her lessons. After that, Marina and June got in the station wagon and Ruth drove them away. Probably to her home in the posh, at least by Oak Cliff standards, suburb of Irving. That address wasn't in Al's notes. He seemed to care little about Marina's relationship with Ruth, probably because he expected to finish Lee long before that rifle ended up in the Payne's garage. But I found it in the phone directory, 2515 West 5th Street. One overcast March afternoon, about 2 hours after Marina and Ruth had departed, Lee and George de Mornschild showed up in de Mornschild's car. Lee got out carrying a brown paper sack with a sombrero and Pepino's Best Mexican printed on the side. De Mornschild had a six-pack of Dos Equis. They went up the outside staircase talking and laughing. I grabbed the earphones, heart pumping. At first, there was nothing, but then one of them turned on the lamp. After that, I might have been in the room with them. An unseen third. "Please don't conspire to kill Walker," I thought, please don't make my job harder than it already is.
Pardon the mess, Lee said. She doesn't do anything much these days but sleep, watch TV, and talk about that woman she's given lessons to.
DeMorn Schultz spoke for a while about some oil leases he was trying to get hold of in Haiti, and spoke harshly of the repressive Duvalier regime.
At the end of the day, trucks drive through the marketplace and pick up the dead. Many of them are children who've starved to death.
Castro in the front will put an end to that, Lee said grimly.
May Providence hasten the day.
There was the clink of bottles, probably to toast the idea of Providence hastening the day.
How is work, comrade? And how is it you're not there this afternoon?
He wasn't there, Lee said, because he wanted to be here. Simple as that. He just punched out and walked away.
What can they do about it? I'm the best damn photoprint technician old Bobby Stovall's got, and he knows it. The foreman? His name is...
I couldn't make it out. Graf?
Grave? Says, quit trying to play labor organizer, Lee. You know what I'd do? I laugh and say, okay, Svenayop,
and walk away. He's a pig dick, and everyone knows it. Still, it was clear Lee liked his job, although he complained about the paternalistic attitude and how seniority counted for more than talent. At one point he said, you know, in Minsk, on a level playing field, I'd be running the place in a year.
I know you would, my son. It's completely evident.
Playing him up, winding him up, I was sure of it.
I didn't like it.
Did you see the paper this morning? Lee asked.
I saw nothing but telegrams and memos this morning. Why do you think I'm here, if not to get away from my desk?
Walker did it, Lee said. He joined up with Hargis's crusade. Or maybe it's Walker's crusade, and Hargis joined up. I can't tell. That fucking midnight ride thing, anyway. Those two ninnies are going to tour the whole South telling people that the NAACP's a communist front. They'll set integration and voting rights back 20 years.
Sure, and fomenting hate. How long before the massacres start?
Or until someone shoots Ralph Abernathy and Dr. King.
Of course King will be shot,
DeMorn Schultz said, almost laughing. I was standing up, my hands pressing the earphones tight to the sides of my head, sweat trickling down my face. This was dangerous ground indeed. The very edge of conspiracy.
It's only a matter of time.
One of them used the church key on another bottle of Mexican beer, and Lee said, someone should stop those two bastards.
You're wrong to call our General Walker a nini,
DeMorn Schultz said in a lecturely tone.
Hargis, yes, okay. Hargis is a choke. What I hear is that he is, like so many of his ilk, a man of twisted sexual appetites. Willing to deedle a little girl's cunt in the morning and a little boy's asshole in the afternoon.
Man, that's sick! Lee's voice broke like an adolescence on the last word. Then he laughed.
But Walker, eh? There's a very different kettle of shrimp. He's high in the John Birch Society. Those Jew-hating fascists. And I can see a day, not long hence, when he may run it. Once he has the confidence and approval of the other right-wing nut groups, he may even run for office again. But this time, not for governor of Texas. I suspect he has his sights aimed higher. The Senate, perhaps, even the White House.
That could never happen. But Lee sounded unsure. It's unlikely to happen, DeMorn Schultz corrected. But never underestimate the American bourgeoisie's capacity
to embrace fascism under the name of populism, or the power of television. Without TV, Kennedy would never have beaten Nixon.
Kennedy and his iron fist, Lee said. His approval of the current president seemed to have gone the way of blue suede shoes. He won't never rest as long as Fidel's shitting in Batista's commode. And never underestimate the terror white America feels at the idea of a society in which racial equality has become the law of the land.
Nigger, 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 beaner, 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 Lee burst out with a rage so great it was nearly anguish. That's all I hear at work.
I'm sure. When the Monarch News says the great state of Texas, what they mean is the hate state of Texas, and people listen. For a man like Walker, a war hero like Walker, a buffoon like Haggis is nothing but the stepping stone, the way von Hindenburg was a stepping stone for Hitler. With the right public relations people to smooth him out, Walker could go far. Do you know what I think? That the men who knocked off General Edwin Racist America Walker would be doing society a favor.
I dropped heavily into a chair beside the table where the little tape recorder sat. It's real spinning.
If you really believe...
Lee began, and then there was a loud buzz that made me snatch the headphones off. There were no cries of alarm or outrage from upstairs, no swift movement of feet, so unless they were very good at covering up on the spur of the moment, I thought I could assume the lamp bug hadn't been discovered. I put the headphones back on. Nothing. I tried the distance mic, standing on a chair and holding the Tupperware bowl almost against the ceiling. With it I could hear Lee talking and DeMoor and Schilt's occasional replies, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. My ear in the Oswald apartment had gone deaf. The past is obdurate. After another 10 minutes of conversation, maybe about politics, maybe about the annoying nature of wives, maybe about newly hatching plans to kill General Edwin Walker, DeMoor and Schilt bounded down the outside stairs and drove away. Lee's footfalls crossed above my head, clump, clud, clump. I followed them into my bedroom and trained the distance mic on the place where they stopped. Nothing. Nothing. Then the faint but unmistakable sound of snoring. When Ruth Payne dropped off Marina and June, 2 hours later, he was still sleeping the sleep of Dos Equis. Marina didn't wake him. I wouldn't have woken the bad-tempered little son of a bitch either. Oswald began to miss a lot more work after that day. If Marina knew, she didn't care. Maybe she didn't even notice. She was absorbed with her new friend, Ruth. The beatings had abated a little, not because morale had improved, but because Lee was out almost as frequently as she was. He often took his camera. Thanks to Al's notes, I knew where he was going and what he was doing. One day, after he'd left for the bus stop, I jumped into my car and drove to Oak Lawn Avenue. I wanted to beat Lee's crosstown bus, and I did, handily. There was plenty of slant-style parking on both sides of Oak Lawn, but my red gull-winged Chevy was distinctive, and I didn't want to risk Lee seeing it. I put it around the corner on Wycliff Avenue, in the parking lot of an Alpha Beta grocery. Then I strolled down to Turtle Creek Boulevard. The houses there were neo-haciendas with arches and stucco siding. There were palm-lined drives, big lawns, even a fountain or two. In front of 4011, a trim man, who bore a striking resemblance to the cowboy actor Randolph Scott, was at work with a push mower. Edwin Walker saw me looking at him and struck a curt half-salute from the side of his brow. I returned the gesture. Lee Oswald's target
resumed mowing, and I moved on. The streets making up the Dallas block I was interested in were Turtle Creek Boulevard, where the general lived, Wycliffe Avenue, where I'd parked, Avondale Avenue, which was where I went after returning Walker's Wave, and Oak Lawn, a street of small businesses that ran directly behind the general's house. Oak Lawn was the one I was most interested in because it was going to be Lee's line of approach and route of escape on the night of April 10th. I stood in front of Texas Shoes and Boots, the collar of my denim jacket raised and my hands stuffed in my pockets. About 3 minutes after I took up this position, the bus stopped at the corner of Oak Lawn and Wycliffe. Two women with cloth shopping bags got off immediately when the doors flopped open. Then Lee descended to the sidewalk. He carried a brown paper bag, like a workman's lunch sack. There was a big stone church on the corner. Lee sauntered over to the iron railing running in front of it, read the notice board, took a small notepad out of his hip pocket and jotted something down. After that, he headed in my direction, tucking the notebook into his pocket as he walked. I hadn't expected that. Al had believed Lee was going to stash his rifle near the railroad tracks on the other side of Oak Lawn Avenue, a good half a mile away. But maybe the notes were wrong, because Lee didn't even glance in that direction. He was 70 or 80 yards away and closing in fast on my position. "He's going to notice me and he's going to speak to me," I thought. "He's going to say, 'Aren't you the guy who lives downstairs? What are you doing here?' If he did, the future would skew off in a new direction. Not good. I stared at the shoes and boots in the show window with sweat dampening the nape of my neck and rolling down my back. When I finally took a chance and shifted my eyes to the left, Lee was gone. It was like a magic trick. I sauntered up the street. I wished I'd put on a cap, maybe even some sunglasses. Why hadn't I? What kind of half-assed secret agent was I, anyway? I came to a coffee shop about halfway along the block, the sign in the window advertising breakfast all day. Lee wasn't inside. Beyond the coffee shop was the mouth of an alley. I walked slowly across it, glanced to my right, and saw him. His back was to me. He had taken his camera out of the paper sack, but wasn't shooting with it, at least not yet. He was examining trash cans. He pulled off the lids, looked inside, then replaced them. Every bone in my body, by which I mean every instinct in my brain, I suppose, was urging me to move on before he turned and saw me, but a powerful fascination held me in place a little longer. I think it would have held most people. How many opportunities do we have, after all, to watch a guy as he goes about the business of planning a cold-blooded murder? He moved a little deeper into the alley, then stopped at a circular iron plate set in a plug of concrete. He tried to lift it. No go. The alley was unpaved, badly potholed, and about 200 yards long. Halfway down its length, the chain link guarding weedy backyards and vacant lots gave way to high board fences draped in ivy that looked less than vibrant after a cold and dismal winter. Lee pushed a mat of it aside and tried a board. It swung out, and he peered into the hole behind it. Axioms about how you have to break eggs to make an omelet were all very fine, but I felt I'd pressed my luck enough. I walked on. At the end of the block, I stopped at the church that had caught Lee's interest. It was the Oak Lawn Church of Latter-day Saints. The notice board said there were regular services every Sunday morning and special newcomer services every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. with a social hour to follow. Refreshments would be served. April 10th was a Wednesday, and Lee's plan, assuming it wasn't Demorenschild's, now seemed clear enough. Hide the gun in the alley ahead of time, then wait until the newcomer's service, and the social hour, of course, was over. He'd be able to hear the worshippers when they came out, laughing and talking as they headed for the bus stop. The buses ran on the quarter hour. There was always one coming along. Lee would take his shot, hide the gun behind the loose board.